Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. The USDA Tuesday announced plans to invest more than $4 billion to strengthen critical supply chains through the Build Back Better initiative. The new effort will strengthen the food system, create new market opportunities, tackle the climate crisis, help communities that have been left behind, and support good-paying jobs throughout the supply chain. That all according to the USDA. USDA says it comes from lessons learned from the COVID-19 pandemic and recent supply chain disruptions. U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack held a call with members of the media. We were on that call. Here are his comments about the funding.
You know, the recent cyber attack, along with the pandemic, have been recent reminders of the fragile nature of the food supply chain in the United States. Supply chain issues have arisen over the course of the last couple of years in a number of sectors of our economy, transportation, energy, manufacturing, to name just three. And President Biden is keenly aware of the impact that this less reliant supply chain has on business and consumers and people in this country, and he's leading an effort with the signing of the executive order 14017 to begin to address the variety of challenges we have relative to supply chain. Today I met along with a number of members of the cabinet to begin the process of looking at the development and formation of a supply chain disruption task force, a whole of government approach, if you will, looking at all of the issues relating to supply chains, including those involved with the food and ag system. I expect and anticipate over the course of the next several months that there'll be a number of convenings of stakeholders to do a deeper analysis of some of the challenges that we face and gain from them some wisdom and knowledge and direction as to how we might be able to strengthen the supply chain. I would say this challenge of the supply chain adds to a number of concerns that have arisen about our current food and ag system, a system where nearly 90% of farms fail to generate a majority of income for those who own and operate the farm, a system that is currently leading to significant productivity gains, but at the expense of an alarming rate of topsoil loss and soil health and water quality. A nutrition system that often provides food but can fail to provide adequate nourishment, and a system that has seen rapid consolidation and a lack of competition. And finally, a system that has lacked equity for socially disadvantaged producers and a fair shot for small and medium-sized producers. This leads me to believe that what we really need is a transformational change in order to build back better our food system and our ag system, one that is economically, environmentally, and nutritionally more resilient and fairer and more open. Today, we are announcing the first of a number of steps designed to address the current supply chain challenge and also to begin that transformational change. Over $4 billion to be invested in order to help build back the system better. This complements a nearly $1 billion investment that we announced last week in food purchases under our emergency food programs, launching an effort to provide more nutritious food to rural and remote areas and working with socially disadvantaged producers. The money we invest today will be invested in four main categories focused on production resiliency, processing resiliency, distribution and aggregation resiliency, and markets and consumer benefits. Let me briefly just explain what we intend to do with these resources and be glad to respond to questions. In the food production area, we hope to make this system more resilient by continuing to build our efforts at attracting beginning farmers by providing significant transition assistance as those who wish to transition to a more value-added proposition are able to do so without necessarily being economically penalized, and assistance as well for those who work on our farm fields and in our manufacturing and processing facilities. On the processing side, we hope to be able to provide resources to improve existing small and mid-sized processing facilities be able to cope and manage with the current challenges that they face as a result of COVID. But we also want to take a look at creating a new opportunity for the federal government to partner with state and local governments to see whether or not there is an opportunity to expand with new processing facilities and capacity in order to make our system more resilient. In the food distribution and aggregation area, we look to be able to expand and increase the number of food hubs, particularly those that will operate in high poverty areas. We look to work with our food banks and those involved to develop cooperative agreements between food banks and producers so that we create additional market opportunities for small and mid-sized producers. And we hope to see an expansion of food banks in underserved areas. In the market area, we hope to increase the availability of access to healthy foods with these resources, including incentives to support food that is generated and developed in a fair and healthy system. And finally, looking forward to an opportunity to expand capacity with the passage of the American Jobs Program and the American Families Program. We look to partner with the efforts that Congress eventually will pass for those two bills to amplify and to expand on our efforts. The resources for this $4 billion plus effort will come from a combination of COVID relief resources, the American Rescue Plan, and some of our traditional programming resources. Over the course of the next several months, we will be announcing specific elements of this, resources that will become available, and we will continue to build on this effort to transform our food system and our ag system so that it is more resilient, it's fairer, it's more open, more transparent, and provides greater resilience in all four of these critical areas.
Secretary Vilsack was also asked about funding for farm labor and if that would be a part of the $4 billion. Here's his response.
I think I had an opportunity to visit with several members of the Senate today about the opportunity to get Senate action on the Ag Modernization, Ag Worker Modernization Act, which would essentially create, I think, a much more stable labor pool, if you will, by providing a mechanism for those who are working here and have worked here permanently, legitimacy, by providing additional H-2A visas, by simplifying that system. There's still work to be done, obviously, in the Senate to get the votes to pass that. It did pass the House in a bipartisan way. So I think it is important and necessary for the Senate to understand that part of the resiliency challenge we have is making sure that the workforce is stable and secure. And one way of doing that would be to address and to pass the bill that the House passed. In the meantime, I think what I can do is make sure that folks understand the significance of this issue and the need for resolution. I think there are a lot of producers out there that are anxious about the workforce. And every single day and every single year, they deal with the same level of challenge and concern about it. So our hope is that that on the farm that we get the Ag Modernization Act through the process, which would certainly be very, very helpful to address the issue. And I think the other opportunity for us is to work collaboratively with the processing community to make sure that we provide the resources that will allow them to continue to provide the protections necessary in the face of COVID so that we don't have the kinds of disruptions that we saw early in the COVID situation.
The Agriculture Department says it will continue to make announcements through the Build Back Better initiative in the months to come. Our news brief is up next. We'll be right back.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board. Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Root Pack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Root Pack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
Here's your news brief for today. June is California Avocado Month. This year's marketing activities include a recipe contest, a drive-in movie event, chef recipes, social media support, public relations outreach, and more. Concurrently, the commission is supporting customized retail and food service promotions that drive awareness of California avocados at the point of purchase. California avocado support programs are taking place throughout the month and begin with a recipe contest that launched earlier in the spring. Two bills introduced in the House of Representatives would help close the gap on rural broadband. Michael Clements shares details on the legislation.
The American Farm Bureau Federation supports two bills that would improve rural broadband connections. AFBF Congressional Relations Director Emily Buckman says Farm Bureau supports the Broadband for Rural America Act by House Agriculture Committee Ranking Member Glenn G.T. Thompson.
Farm Bureau is extremely appreciative of the Ag Committee's effort in trying to tackle the digital divide. Rural broadband is something that we do see as a bipartisan issue, and the legislation would provide over $7 billion in authorizations, including making permanent the Reconnect program, which has provided lots of support for our rural communities.
Farm Bureau also supports the Eliminating Barriers to Rural Internet Development Grant Eligibility Act.
This legislation was introduced by a ranking member of the House Transportation Infrastructure Committee, Sam Graves, out of Missouri. This legislation seeks to provide additional flexibility to the Economic Development Administration whenever it comes to funding to support broadband programming in rural communities.
Buckman says broadband is a necessity for rural America.
These pieces of legislation are extremely important because, as we've all seen, broadband is a necessity, and our rural communities still lag behind our urban counterparts. And these pieces of legislation focus in on providing resources to rural communities that lack it.
Michael Clements, Washington.
The Optimizing the Cattle Market Act of 2021, introduced in the House of Representatives Tuesday, seeks to change cattle market dynamics. Introduced by Missouri Republican Representative Vicki Hartzler, the legislation would direct the Agriculture Department to create a cattle formula contracts library and increase the reporting window for cattle committed from 7 days to 14 days. The measures, according to the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, would increase transparency in the industry and improve the opportunity for robust price discovery. How do plant-based hamburger patties compare to traditional beef patties? The results of a scientific study may surprise you. Gary Crawford has more.
As we get into May and the summer grilling season, there will be a lot of hamburgers on grills across the country. Hamburgers, yes. Most of us will be grilling the usual ground beef patties, but some may be considering plant-based alternative patties.
Many of the claims that come along with this is that they are similar to ground beef in eating quality as well as all the other characteristics.
Ah, but are they? That's what Travis O'Quinn and his fellow researchers at Kansas State University wanted to find out scientifically by
testing these products in a head-to-head comparison with ground beef to see how closely they actually did imitate ground beef.
The results surprised him and may surprise you. So Travis and the team rounded up 120 consumers who said they did eat beef, paid them to participate to eat hamburger patties. That was the easy part of the study, right, Travis?
Yeah, we don't ever struggle to find people to eat.
Probably not.
And we just told them that they were going to come in and they were going to eat hamburger patties. And we actually had them eat six different types of hamburger patties. We had the three ground beef alternatives, one of which was a retail ground beef alternative, so one that was commonly found in grocery stores. We also had a food service ground beef alternative, which is found in many of the restaurants. And then we had a traditional soy patty that's more similar to the type of ground beef alternatives that would have came into play many years ago.
The test subjects also ate three different types of ground beef, 10% fat, 20%, and 30%. None of the patties had any flavor enhancements, no salt, pepper, mustard, nothing in there. And this was a blind study, and so
We did not provide them any context that some of those were going to be plant-based alternatives nor that some of them would be ground beef. So all they knew is they were going to be evaluating six different hamburger patties.
The consumers were asked to evaluate each patty, rating on things like flavor, juiciness, overall acceptability. The alternatives were also tested in the lab for various traits like color and how they cooked up, did they shrink or get bigger or fall apart or whatever. All kinds of tests and evaluations, again, checking how closely the plant-based alternatives came to the beef products.
Our results were pretty clear.
And so, here are the results. Basically, there were few, if any, similarities between the beef patties and the plant-based alternatives.
All of those aspects that we were able to measure demonstrated that these were a very different food product than the ground beef that we were comparing it to.
Different not in a favorable way either. And so when it was all said and done,
all three of those ground beef products had over 75% of samples rated acceptable. In comparison, our three ground beef alternatives ranged from somewhere around 50% down to as low as 22% of samples rated acceptable overall for overall eating quality of the products.
So Travis says if you're looking to try a plant-based burger for a change,
you will be experiencing a different eating quality and with a very different type of product.
But he says a product that is constantly being improved and could, with technology, someday come close to the eating quality of beef, but not yet. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
A proposal to list the lesser prairie chicken as endangered in parts of Texas and New Mexico is drawing concerns beyond agriculture. The listing would create problems to oil and gas development in the largest U.S. petroleum basin and would be problematic for wind power. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced the proposal last month for areas in Texas, New Mexico, and southwest Kansas. Bloomberg Law reports the Fish and Wildlife Service is considering a possible mile-wide zone around each wind turbine that the agency would assume the bird could no longer live. The last month of the U.S. Drought Monitor coverage indicates a mixed bag of news regarding farm commodities and drought. Rod Bain reports.
Despite what was a decline in overall drought coverage in the contiguous U.S. during the month of May,
47% was the number as we started May. 44% is the U.S. drought coverage as we move into early June.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says drought intensification in specific regions increased concerns regarding some agricultural commodities and drought impacts to such. Take the West, where drought expansion continued, and in particular,
we saw short-term drought intensifying in the Northwest.
The Northern Plains also experienced a month-over-month increase in drought coverage. Rippey says concerns rose about drought impacting specific crops in the Northwest and Northern Plains.
On June 1st, we are looking at 55% of the U.S. barley production area in drought. Also seeing very high numbers on crops like spring wheat, 79% of the production area. Also durum wheat, the number on June 1st is 88%. And then finally, sunflowers in drought, 83% in drought.
Another region of the country where increasing dryness and potential drought could start to impact crops and livestock, the Eastern Seaboard.
Particularly in parts of New York State, New England, and then the middle and southern Atlantic states, all seeing a drying trend as we move through May, and that did lead to some increase in stress on emerging summer crops as well as pastures.
Now, some areas of the nation report a slight drought respite. Rippey says the southern plains saw appreciable rains in May and reduced commodities in drought.
A nice boost for spring pasture and rangeland growth helped out the winter wheat crop and certainly helped out any spring sown crops.
And for corn and soybeans, about one quarter of those crops nationwide are in drought. Little change month over month. Yet Rippey points out regarding corn and beans.
Do you see a strip of drought across the northern corn belt, generally stretching from the Dakotas to Michigan? Not enough to impact early crop growth, but certainly something to watch as we move into the summer.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's our news brief for today. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. That is there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The Citrus Research Board continues its webinar series Tuesday with a discussion on pest management and an industry update. There were two speakers featured. Coming up in our show next Tuesday, you'll hear Sonia Rios, the Area Subtropical Horticulture Advisor for the Cooperative Extension Riverside County. Today, we have for you Dr. Sandeepa Gautam, an assistant researcher entomologist at the UC Kearney Agricultural Center. She talked about several topics in Citrus IPM. Here are some of her comments.
So let's jump to Acinetus citrus psyllid now. ACP is a small insect, as small as an aphid. It likes to deposit eggs on the new flush. And flush is the term we hear a lot with ACP and citrus. What it means is it's that new growth that's just coming out, which is very tender and soft and perfect for feeding for insects, sap-sucking insects like Acinetus citrus psyllid. The Acinetus citrus psyllid, what it does, the adult finds a growing flush and lays the egg in there, and eggs, when they hatch, they start feeding. The nymphs start feeding on that new flush as it develops and broadens and expands. The nymphs can only survive on the new tender flush, so the adults are, so if you're looking for Acinetus citrus psyllid, it's best to look in the new flush, because that's where they are, that's where all the action is happening. Getting started with the scouting and monitoring, let's first think about what makes ACP move and disperse. Thinking like an ACP, adults can fly, nymph movement is limited. So if adults, you know, decide that they want to fly, they will go find a new new tree or new flush to reproduce and feed on. That may be triggered by disturbance, which could be during the normal operations like harvesting or insecticide application or pruning of the trees. That triggers disturbance, and ACP feels like it needs to take off and go find a new tree to land on. Another theory is that after reaching a certain density, ACP will move and find new areas to infest. And we don't really know what that number is, but it's likely that as the population gets dense and dense, the adults tend to move and find newer areas to infest. Another reason might be the availability and the quality of food. Psyllids like soft, tender food. And if there is a new flush on the, you know, like next tree, then they would move to that new flush, and that's how they penetrate from Acinetus into the orchard. The other way that ACP could move is passive dispersal, when people move psyllids on plants, vehicles, equipments, and bulk surface. And for scouting, there are two methods, passive scouting and active scouting. Passive is using yellow sticky cards to monitor for populations. It is a great tool for monitoring dispersal into newer areas because it can be strategically placed along the edges of the grove. It's constantly out there over time, and you can replace it, and you can count, and you can have an idea of how things are progressing over time. Disadvantage to passive scouting is it's labor intensive. You have to find and replace those traps every week or bi-weekly, and it can get costly. You also need trained personnel to identify, you know, those people who are looking at the cards to be trained to identify ACPs. And sometimes you might be getting false negatives, meaning that you may not find any adults on the card, but you may have a population in your block. Active scouting is when you are in the grove actively looking for essence tetracetid. And there are two types. One is visual sampling, that is finding the flush and counting the number of eggs, nymphs, and adults in the flush. You need a hand lens for this because eggs and nymphs are small, harder to see, and they are pretty much tucked. They can be tucked inside that growing flush. Where there is no young flush, another way to sample for adults is using the tap sampling method. And what you do in this is you use a mallet, something that you can tap with, and you pick a branch that's about 1 inch in diameter, and you tap that really hard onto a surface and catch whatever falls of that branch and count the adults. And because of the disturbance, the adults just fall and like to lay there. They're not going to fly, and you can pretty much do the counts. If you're looking for a perfect method, combining passive with active sampling is ideal. You might want to replace the yellow sticky cards biweekly, and based on that number, do the visual sampling when there is flush, go with the tap sampling method when there is no flush, always focus on the edges of the grove because that's where ACP likes to hang out before moving on to the interior of the block. And once you do this over many, many seasons, you might get an idea of where in your block ACP starts infesting, and you might identify your hotspot. So it's a good idea to start from your identified hotspot and then move from there. Where ACP is not established, especially in the valley, passive sampling using yellow sticky cards, and whenever there is a find, then you go to visual sampling. The goal for essence tetracetid management, especially for the valley, is to reduce the psyllid and the number of spread of the disease together with the psyllid. Current approach is ACP and HLP quarantine. There are different reasons, zones established based on the ACP find and HLP find, and there are regulations that are required, that the growers are required to spray and then move the fruit between these quarantine zones 14 days before the harvest with an approved insecticide that controls essence tetracetid. Some of these are Danitol, Bathroid, Tombstone, Mustang, Actara, etc. Or another option is to field clean, remove all the stems and leaves and brush and wash the fruit before moving. It's not a very good idea because washing fruit creates other issues with the fruit. Tarping is another regulation that is required. 100% of the citrus load that is traveling between quarantine zones for bulk citrus are required to be tarp. And in future, post-harvest treatment is needed for bulk citrus. And we have worked on evergreen fogging and ethylformate fumigation, which are very effective options. We evaluated ethylformate to control ACP in bulk citrus in Riverside in 2019, where what we did is we had the ACP in these modified cases, which were then buried in fruit within all the bins. And then it was tarped with the tarpaulin and fumigated with ethylformate during 1 hour fumigation at ambient temperature, which was around 60 degrees that day. And we killed all the essence tetracetid. This fumigant, ethylformate, is in the process of registration and may soon be available as a treatment option. ACP management goals, especially here in the valley, are to prevent ACP coming into the valley. Despite all these regulations, we still see psyllid on trap cuts from time to time, which is shown here on this table. There are some years where we start seeing ACP. I think 2015 is where we start seeing ACP, which triggers eradicative coordinated treatments, which is application of two insecticides during a 30-day interval. It could be two foliar insecticides or foliar followed by a systemic insecticide, which then you would apply immediately after the foliar application because systemic insecticide takes longer to get absorbed and be, you know, make it to the tree. The eradicative treatment is fairly effective because you see a high population, there is an eradicative treatment that growers are required to treat 800 meters, and you knock that population down. Next year, you don't see ACPs, but then again, it's coming into the valley. In Southern California, growers treat together over a 2 to 3 week window. Usually in fall and winter, that's coordinated by PMAs and pest control districts using the insecticides that have known efficacy against Acinetobacter citricillate. In urban areas, in residential and in the household, they release Tamaraxia parasite to control Acinetobacter citricillate. And within the HLB quarantine, conventional treatment to keep ACP populations in check.
We will have more in Tuesday's show, and the CRB continues its webinar series next Tuesday as well. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Climate change once again takes center stage for national lawmakers as a panel of environment experts testified to the House Homeland Security Subcommittee on Energy Preparedness, Response, and Communications, all about the threat of climate change. Among the witnesses, science educator and CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, also known for his show, Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Subcommittee, thank you indeed for the opportunity to testify before you today. It is an honor to share my thoughts on climate change and the threats our nation faces because of it. My name is Bill Nye. As you may infer, these days I'm a science educator and a television presenter. I may be known to you and your families as the Science Guy. I began my career as a mechanical engineer working at Boeing. My professional license is still in Washington State. I worked on aviation's FEMA acronym, Failure Effects and Modes Analysis. I was paid to solve physics problems and figure out what could go wrong on a 747 airplane. I learned a great many things. First, a modern jetliner is an amazingly reliable, extraordinarily safe machine, largely because it is subject to good regulations. Second, commercial airplanes only get into trouble when they take off with something that's already broken. A system the crew thought was working isn't working, then several things go wrong at once. And when it comes to climate change, the analogy to things already broken, along with multiple problems developing at the same time, is compelling. Suppose Russian hackers had attacked the Colonial Pipeline while a hurricane was coming ashore at Gulfport, Mobile, or Gainesville. Recently, the entire state of Texas, as was mentioned earlier, was shut down because of a snap of cold weather. It was the product of years of insufficient failure effects and modes analysis. It killed almost 200 people. Along with the heartache, the cost is estimated at $130 billion. These miserable outcomes could have been avoided for a fraction of what we'll all end up paying. The pipeline hack was a mean-spirited thing and a lot of trouble. The mess in Texas was a disaster. But the next time, or the next times, may be much, much worse. Back in 1977, as you may have heard, I took a course from Professor Carl Sagan. It eventually led to my day job as CEO of the Planetary Society. And Dr. Sagan often spoke of what he called comparative planetology. By comparing Earth's atmosphere with those of Mars and Venus, scientists came to understand the importance of carbon dioxide and the greenhouse effect. You may have heard, researchers at Exxon understood this too and wrote about the potential for disasters back in that same 1977. But we've done almost nothing about it. Greenhouse gases are inducing climate change here on Earth, and it's happening now on larger and larger scales. We're seeing bigger storms, more floods, more droughts, more fires, more loss of shoreline, and more businesses and people displaced as the ocean swells. Therefore, the sooner we stop adding greenhouse gases to our air, the better off we have a chance of being. If we don't stop, more of these events will happen, more of them will happen at the same time, and that will increase the likelihood of convergent problems. It was stated earlier in her opening statement, the ranking member said, we can't control the weather. It turns out we are controlling the weather. Inadvertently, by accident, we are controlling the weather and we got to cut it out. Now, everything on an airplane, from the wheel under the nose to the light on the tip top of the tail, is there for a reason. Anything extra that you put on an airplane would add weight, which would shorten the range, make the plane less efficient, make it more costly to fly. But even with that in mind, airplanes are required to carry all sorts of emergency equipment. Life vests, rafts, exit doors right in the middle that no one ever uses. You want the plane to have everything it needs to fly normally, but also everything it needs when things go wrong. These regulations are good. They keep us safe. So just like extra pieces and parts of an airplane that you don't need, we don't want regulations that we don't need. But when it comes to addressing climate change, regulations are essential. Having healthy neighborhoods where things do not stop working is a way to keep people healthy and working. It's why we have infrastructure like smoke detectors, fire hydrants, and all of that plumbing, so firefighters can keep us and the built environment we rely on safe. Now, this is where you all come in, members of this subcommittee. We want all the rules we need to create all the systems we need to address climate change. Now, as you may know, I grew up right here in Washington, D.C. I rode my Schwinn bicycle to the first few Earth Day events on the National Mall. I locked my bicycle to a flagpole, probably not allowed these days. But back then, we emphasized individual actions. Every little bit hurts. That was one of the slogans.
Also testifying about climate change and the environment, Alice Hill, who is the David Rubenstein Senior Fellow for Energy and Environment at the Council on Foreign Relations.
Thank you so much, Chairwoman Demings and Ranking Member Kamik, and members of the subcommittee for inviting me to testify today. As we've heard, climate change impacts are no longer a matter for the distant future. Last year, in the midst of a global pandemic, our country suffered 22 separate extreme weather events influenced by climate, each costing over $1 billion. And that's been going on for quite a long time, seeing the United States pummeled by worsened disasters from climate change. America is simply not doing enough to prepare for the heightened threats posed by a changing climate. The nation, in short, suffers from a large resilience gap. That gap needs to be closed to safeguard homeland security. Development of a national resilience strategy is essential, as you've noted, Chairwoman. Without a comprehensive approach, individual agency efforts could leave gaping holes in the nation's resilience to climate threats. The Department of Homeland Security can and should play a central role in the effort to build a national resilience plan. Core to resilience is improved risk communication. The United States lacks comprehensive risk mapping that is sufficiently downscaled to inform Americans regarding the risks they face now, much less those they face in the near future. That means that we have many families and businesses who today rent and buy facilities that are destined to burn and flood. The federal government should compile risk information in a way that's easy to understand, interactive, has a visual format that permits people to determine what's ahead. What does it mean for me? What does it mean for my family? What does it mean for my company? And what does it mean for the United States? Without that, it's difficult for us to make the kinds of risk reduction choices that we need to make. As Representative Kamik has stated, we need to prepare ahead. A national resilience plan would help us do that, and it would provide incentives to improve decision-making about where and how we build. As you know, land use and building code choices rest almost entirely in the hands of state and local governments in the United States. Currently, those officials encounter a moral hazard when they make choices about where building should occur and how it should occur, since they know that the federal government may well end up footing most or all of the disaster costs after disaster strikes. This moral hazard has led to risky development occurring in many places across the nation. We also need stronger building codes. As you've heard, according to the National Institute of Building Sciences, for every $1 we spent in disaster resistant building codes, we can avert $11 in damages. But despite this astonishingly high cost benefit, 65% of cities and towns across this nation have failed to adopt modern disaster resistant codes. The nation needs to accelerate the development and adoption of model building codes that account for future climate risk. To protect homeland security, the nation also must work to ensure that critical infrastructure continues to perform under new extremes. We saw this in Texas, as it's been mentioned. We will see this in California this summer when wildfires streak across that state, and we will see it as hurricanes that are predicted to occur this season hit the United States. When infrastructure fails, particularly the electric sector, the damage cascades through all sectors, public health, transportation, communication. And we need to have resilient infrastructure that can take what we know will come with climate change. Climate change will also drive increased migration. We know that changing conditions can affect transnational crime, including terrorism. During extreme events, organized crime and extremists have been known to take advantage of a failed government response to expand their territory and increase recruitment. We'll also see increased pressure at our borders, as we're currently seeing with Central American immigrants. Immigrants that are seeking survival will move in the face of devastating climate events, either droughts or hurricanes, as we saw two back-to-back hurricanes this year in Central America. We need frameworks to get ahead and do this better, plan for where people will move.
You can find that full hearing on the subcommittee website. That's our show for today. If you'd like to send me a comment, you can email me, sabrina@myaglife.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.